This is the first chapter where we actually look at a firm that is part of a particular market. Now, when we look at, we're going to assume we own a business and we want to make certain decisions. And two decisions that we want to make is what price are we going to charge and what quantity we're going to produce to maximize the profit. Because there's only one unique price that we can charge whereby we'll maximize our profit or maybe minimize our losses. If we charge more than that price, we'll make less money. If we charge less than that, we'll make less money. There's only one unique quantity that we can produce whereby we'll maximize profit. If we produce more than that amount, we'll make less money. If we produce less than that amount, we'll make less money. So, see, what is microeconomics all about? Microeconomics is all about what? The decision-making process of economics, right? We want to know how to make right decisions. Now, in this case, we want to know how to make right decisions in terms of maximizing our profit or minimizing our losses if we're a business owner. Now, what we're going to learn is that when analyzing this, it makes a difference of what type market that we're in. And I believe that will bring us to the next slide. See, what are the four types of markets? The first type that we talk about in this chapter is this chapter is on perfect competition.
Eight.
And then the next chapter will be on monopoly. And then in between these two extremes, we've got a tight market called monopolistic competition and a market called oligopoly. Now, each of these markets is different. Now, what we're going to do is we're going to assume that we own a business and we want to make decisions. And we're going to say, okay, now, what would our decision-making process look like if we were in a perfectly competitive market? All right, what would our decision-making process look like if we were in a monopolistic market? Okay, what would our decision-making process look if we're in a monopolistic competitive market or an oligopoly? So this will take up the next three chapters, and then at the end of those chapters, this will complete this unit that is called price output determination. All right? So the first thing we got to do is, what is a perfectly competitive market? If this chapter is on a perfectly competitive type market, then we've got to make sure we know what exactly is a perfectly competitive market. And so here is a list of some of the characteristics of a perfectly competitive market. First of all, a perfectly competitive market will have what is called a homogeneous product. Now, what is a homogeneous product? Well, that means that in this market, we are producing something that we cannot distinguish from our competitors. See, for example, if you were a potato farmer and you harvest your potatoes and you take your potatoes to market, can you differentiate your potatoes from all other potato farmers? And the answer is no. You know, we dump all the potatoes in a big pile and they all look the same. See, that's what's called a homogeneous product. When you can't distinguish yourself from your competitors, then that's one of the characteristics of a perfectly competitive market. The second characteristic of this type market is that there are many buyers and many sellers. Now, what do we mean by the word many? Well, one way of looking at it is there are too many buyers and sellers for those buyers and sellers to come together, like all the buyers or all the sellers, for them to meet in a one location to determine what would be the best price for everybody. Now, that's called collusion, by the way. Collusion is when you, instead of competing with your competitor, you cooperate with your competitor and both of you agree on a price. See, that's called collusion. Now, collusion is not possible in a perfectly competitive market. How come? Because there are too many buyers to collude amongst one another. And there are too many sellers to collude against, to collude amongst one another. You see what I mean? There's simply too many. And so that's what we mean by many, many. All right, the third characteristic is no one has much market power. Now, market power would be that for some reason, and there may be several different reasons, but for some reason, you've got an edge in the market. You know, that edge, what we're going to find out later on with the other type markets is that edge might be name recognition, or it might be that you were maybe the first one in the market, or maybe you control a good amount of a necessary resource, or maybe you've got some government protection going for you in some form or another. But here, in perfect competition, none of those things is possible. All right? In perfect competition, what we're assuming, what we've got here is we've got many, many buyers and many, many sellers. No one buyer and seller can differentiate oneself from one another, and no one buyer or seller has any appreciable market power. They can't influence the market to meet their own needs. Now, of course, not everyone is equal in this type market. I mean, you've got some big farmers and you've got some little farmers, for example, because farming is perhaps the best example of a perfectly competitive market. But you might have big farmers and you might have little farmers, but even the biggest farmer, what we're saying here, even the biggest farmer, relative to the whole market, is still very small. And therefore, even the biggest farmers cannot influence the market price. All right? So that's what we mean by no one has much market power. A fourth characteristic of a perfectly competitive market is that we have easy entry and easy exit. Now, what does that mean? Well, that means is that if you want to become a part of this market, it's very easy to enter into this type market. And if you want to leave this type market, it's very easy to leave this market. You know, for example, if you want to be a tomato farmer, how much land would you need? Or at least what's the minimum amount of land that you would have to become a tomato farmer? How about a square foot? If you had a square foot of land, a soil, could you grow one tomato plant? Mm-hmm. And that one tomato plant may give you, I don't know, 8 to 10 to 12 tomatoes, right? And then when those tomatoes are ripe, you pick those tomatoes, you take them to the side of the road, you put them in a box, you put up a sign, it says tomatoes for sale, and guess what? You're a tomato farmer. See how easy it is to enter into this industry? Now here it is, you're sitting side of the road, it's a hot summer day, and you're sitting underneath the shade of a tree, and you get kind of hungry, and you've got some salt maybe, so you eat one tomato, and boy, that was really good, and you eat the second tomato, and a few hours goes by, and lo and behold, you ate all your tomatoes. Well, guess what? Guess what? You're no longer a tomato farmer. See, you've got no more tomatoes for sale. See how easy it is to leave that industry? I mean, you know, compare that with other type industries where there's a lot more involved. You know, it's not so easy to enter into most type industries. That there are what are called obstacles, they're called barriers to entry, which can be take on many different forms. And if you've got a certain commitment in terms of buildings and machines and employees, sometimes it's not so easy just to leave an industry. But in perfect competition, it's very easy to enter in, and it's very easy to exit from. That's one of the characteristics. Now keep this in mind. When we talk about perfect competition, if a firm doesn't meet all of these criteria, then that simply means that the firm is not a part of a perfectly competitive market. It's a part of another type market. See what I mean? See, what we're saying here is that if we're talking about a perfectly competitive market, then all the firms in this market have to meet all of these characteristics. Otherwise, they're not part of a perfectly competitive market. All right, lastly, in a perfectly competitive market, a seller can sell everything that is brought to market, provided that the seller sells the product at the market price. See, now, let's say you're this tomato farmer, and you've got a bunch of tomatoes. Well, when you bring these tomatoes to market, whatever the market price is, then it doesn't make any difference how many tomatoes you bring to market. You can sell all of them at the market price. Now, how come this is one of the characteristics? Because you are so small relative to the total market. That when you bring your tomatoes to market, you might bring 10 truckloads, and to you that may seem like a lot of tomatoes, but it's still a drop in the bucket compared to the total market. And because you were so small relative to the total market, then the number of tomatoes you bring to market is just, it's almost insignificant. And therefore, as long as you charge the market price, you can sell everything you bring to market. Now, related to this characteristic is that if you charge more than the market price, you won't be able to sell anything. You'll be able to sell zero tomatoes. Let's say the market price is $5 a bushel. So you bring your tomatoes to market, and you say to yourself, you know, I've worked hard planting and harvesting these tomatoes, and $5 a bushel just doesn't seem like enough money to me. So I'm going to charge $5.25 a bushel. Well, who in their right mind would buy from you at $5.25 if they can buy from hundreds of other farmers that are selling exactly the same thing for $5 a bushel? You're not going to find anybody, right? I mean, there's no reason for anyone to buy from you.
Unless you live out in the boonies with nobody else around.
Yeah, but we're assuming here that the market is, you know, buyers and sellers have congregated. We have a market here. And we're talking about a particular tight market. In this tight market, you've got many, many buyers and many, many sellers. That's one of the characteristics. And so if you charge more than the market price, you won't sell anything. If you charge the market price, you can sell everything you bring to market. Okay, now what is a price taker? A price taker is a firm that faces a given market price and whose actions have no effect on that market price. A price taker is really what it says. A price taker is a firm that has to take whatever the market price is. Now, see, in the other type markets, we're going to learn that there are firms that are what are called price makers. There are other, in the other type markets, there are firms that can dictate their price. They can say, well, I'm going to charge this price, or I'm going to charge that price. But in perfect competition, that's not the case. In perfect competition, all firms are price takers. They have to take whatever the market price dictates. Why is a firm that's part of a perfectly competitive market a price taker? Because if the firm charges higher than the market price, it will not even sell one unit. So I've already talked about that. Okay, and here is the picture of what determines the market price. Now, is the equilibrium price the same thing as the market price? What do you think? Huh? And why not? What is the difference? What is the difference between the equilibrium price and the market price? And you can answer that in one word. What's that one word that you can answer that? What is the difference between the equilibrium price and the market price? In one word. Anybody? Well, that one word is time. Time. You see, you take you've got this downward sloping demand curve and an upward sloping supply curve. And let's say that the demand curve shifts to the right. Now, what's going to happen to the equilibrium price? Huh? Well, what's going to happen to the equilibrium price? This is pretty basic stuff here. If demand shifts to the right, then the equilibrium price will increase. But does the market price increase? Not right away. How come? Because there are always three time lags. There's the recognition lag, the decision lag, and the action lag. See, let's say you're a firm that's part of a perfect competitive market, and the demand for your product shifts to the right. Well, do you know that instantaneously? And the answer is no. It's going to take a little while for you to recognize that, hey, demand has increased. All right, now that you know demand has increased, it's going to take you a little time to decide what to do about that increase in demand. And then after you decide what to do about that increase in demand, it's going to take another little time for you to put into action what you have decided to do. Now, after these three time lags, what happens to the market price? It increases. See, the demand increases, the equilibrium price increases, and then after a little while, after these time lags, the market price increases. Now, if demand shifts to the left, what happens to the equilibrium price? It's going to go down, right? But does the market price go down right away? No. There's all these time lags. The equilibrium price can go down, and then after a little while, the market price will go down. So in essence, the market price is always chasing after the equilibrium price. The equilibrium price determines what happens to the market price. Now, in this analysis here, we're just going to assume that these two are the same. We're going to talk about the equilibrium price and the market price as pretty much one and the same, just for simplification. But I just want you to know that they're not one and the same. So anyway, here we have a downward sloping demand curve, and we got this upward sloping supply curve. Now, why are demand curves downward sloping? Huh? Now, come on, this is pretty basic. Well, because as price goes down, what happens to the quantity demanded? Yeah, people are going to say, well, we want to buy more at those lower prices, right? And as price goes up, people say, well, we want to buy less at those higher prices. Now, why are supply curves got a positive slope? Why is it that when the price goes up, the quantity supply goes up? And you can answer that in one word. What's that one word? What's that one word? Why is it that as price goes up, the quantity supply goes up? And as price goes down, the quantity supply goes down? What's that one word? No. Well, that one word is incentive. Incentive. See, as price goes up, suppliers have more incentive to increase the quantity supply. Now, how come that is? Because they can make more money. How do we know they can make more money as price goes up? Exactly, exactly. Because we always assume that everything else remains the same. So if price goes up, now what we're saying here is that it's not you necessarily that's raising the price, but it's the market that's dictating a higher price for your product, right? And if the market dictates a higher price for your product, and of course the market is demand and supply for your product. So as the price goes up, you can make more money because we're assuming here that everything else stays the same. If your costs stay the same, but the price for your product goes up, then you're going to make more money. And why are you in business? Well, you're in business to maximize your profit. So as prices go up for your product, you're going to have more incentive to increase the quantity supplied. Now notice here I'm talking about the quantity supplied and I'm not talking about supply. Because when we change price, what changes?
Quantity
changes. Either quantity demanded or quantity supplied. Because we're moving along a stationary curve. So supply curves have a positive slope because as the price goes up, the quantity supply goes up, and as the price goes down, the quantity supply goes down. This is a direct relationship between price and quantity. The reason is incentive on the part of the seller, the one who's doing the supplying. So anyway, here we've got these two demand curves. Now, why is the intersection of where quantity demand equals quantity supplied the equilibrium price? Well, yes, they do agree. At the equilibrium price, they do agree because the quantity supplied equals the quantity demanded. So, I mean, that is an answer. But how would we prove that? I mean, you're correct, but how would we prove that? Well, the proof is right here. See, as price goes up, what did demanders say to themselves? We want less, correct? And what did suppliers say to themselves?
We want more.
We want to supply more. Well, with demanders saying we want less and suppliers saying we want to supply more, what results? A surplus. More units being supplied than being demanded. And in a free market, how do we get rid of the surplus? Price goes down. Down toward where quantity demand equals quantity supply. Now, what happens when price goes below where quantity demand equals quantity supply? Well, as price goes down, what do suppliers say to themselves? We don't want to make as much. We don't want to supply as much. But what do demanders say to themselves as price goes down? Hey, we want to buy more. Well, with suppliers saying we're going to supply less and demanders saying we want to buy more, what results?
Shortage.
Now, in a free market, how do we decide who gets when there's a shortage?
Whoever has the most money.
Willing and able.
Willing and able. Money and a want to, right? People bid against one another like at an auction, and the highest bidders get, and those other people don't get. So what have we proven here? Well, what we've proven is that where quantity demand equals quantity supply is the equilibrium price. And like I say, in this chapter, we're going to assume that this equilibrium price is also the market price. All right? Now, the firm's demand curve in perfect competition. What determines a firm's demand curve? What determines a firm's demand curve is market supply and market demand. See, on the left, we have this downward sloping demand curve, which is a capital D, which stands for market demand, and we've got a capital S, which stands for market supply. Where they intersect is the market price. Now, whatever that price is, this is equal to a firm's short-run demand curve. Now, notice on the right, we have a horizontal line equal to where quantity demand equals quantity supply, and that horizontal line has a small d. Now, the reason why it's got a small d and not a capital D is that we're saying this is the demand curve for one firm that is part of this market. See, what does the demand curve look like for the whole market? It's downward sloping. But what does the demand curve look like for a single firm? It's horizontal. Now, why is the demand curve horizontal? Well, the demand curve is determined by the market price. But why does the demand curve, why does it make sense in all that we've just talked about, why is it necessary for the demand curve to be horizontal at the market price? See, I guess the point I'm making here is that if you don't know why things are related as they are, or why they look like they do on a graph or a chart, then you're really not going to understand these concepts. You've got to look at it and just say, oh yeah, well, of course, that makes sense. How else could it be? Now, why is the demand curve for a single firm horizontal at the market price? And the reason is because at the market price, a firm can sell everything that is brought to market. So you notice here that at this price, the demand curve is horizontal because, well, it's infinite. I mean, quantity is infinite. You see? I mean, at this price, quantity is infinite because theoretically, at this price, we can sell everything we bring to market. Now, what happens if you charge more than the market price? How many units are you going to sell? Zero, right? Well, now, if you go above this price, anywhere above it, and you go across to the right, and you go across to the right, and you keep on going. Are you ever going to intersect the demand curve? No, because the demand curve is always going to be below you. You know, if you bring your tomatoes to market and the market price is $5 and you say to yourself, well, I'm not satisfied with that $5. I'm going to charge $5.25. Well, are you going to sell even one tomato? You see, no matter what, it's zero. You're going to sell zero tomatoes. Well, now what would a demand curve look like in order to fit that description? What would the demand curve look like if we're going to say, okay, at this price you can sell everything, but anything above this price you sell zero units? Well, the only demand curve that could fit that description is a horizontal line at the market price. And so that horizontal line at the market price is a firm's short-run demand curve. Now, by the way, I'm using this term short run, and this goes back to the previous chapter, because see, so much of what we learned in the previous chapter, now we're going to apply. What is the difference between the short run and the long run? Capacity. You can answer that in one word, right? And that one word, you're exactly right, that is capacity. The short run can be 100 years, and the long run can be 1 week. The short run and the long run is not in reference to time. The short run and long run is in reference to, can you change your capacity or not? Or have you changed your capacity to produce or not? In the short run, we're saying that you can increase your production up and down, and there are certain things you can change, but you can't change your capacity to produce. Now, once you change your capacity to produce, then we're into the long run. Now, when we're talking about these things, about price output determination in these different type markets, what time frame are we assuming? The short run. We always assume the short run, unless otherwise stated. Now, if I don't say short run or long run, then we're talking about the short run. If I want to talk about the long run, because there are cases here where we do talk about the long run, then I have to say, in the long run, such and such and such and such. Okay, how does the firm maximize profit? Where are profits maximized? Not quite, but you're, no. How does the firm maximize profit? By finding the rate of output that makes total revenue minus total cost as large as possible, right? And that would look like this. You see, here's total revenue, which is a straight line because, now, another characteristic here is that we are selling everything at the market price, right? If the market price is $5 a bushel, then every time we sell a unit, we're adding $5 to our total revenue. So it's constant. So this total revenue line is constant from the origin. And then we have a total cost curve. And the total cost curve represents the law of diminishing returns. But there's a place, a certain number of units, where the difference between total revenue and total cost is the greatest. And that would be where we maximize our profit. Now, we don't look at these totals very much. This is just an explanation of, well, this is one way of looking at it. But what we really deal with here in terms of our decision making is marginal. And we're going to use marginal analysis. So what is the definition of marginal revenue?
What you get for the last unit.
Exactly. What you get for the last unit. And you can underline that word last, right? Because that's what margin means, the last. The change in total revenue resulting from a one unit change in sales. And what is marginal cost? What you pay for that last unit. The change in total cost resulting from one unit change in sales. So, at what point are profits maximized?
Marginal revenue minus marginal cost?
No. Your profits are maximized where MR equals MC. Or the last unit of output where MR is greater than MC, since it makes no difference. Now, this could be the most important slide of the whole semester, right here. This is the key to almost everything we do in microeconomics. See, what is microeconomics again? Decision making. And what analysis do we use to make decision? Marginal analysis. From the first day you were born, you used marginal analysis to make decisions whereby you were always attempting to maximize your welfare. All right? Marginal analysis. It's something you've always known, you've always used from the first day you were born. And all we're doing here in this economics course is that we're revealing to you how you have always thought. What thought process have you gone through each and every time you have made a decision in your life? And you make hundreds of decisions every day, both consciously and unconsciously. So how do we explain this? Why? How would you prove to me? Now let's say I don't know anything about this. And you come to me and you say, your profits would be maximized if you produce where your marginal revenue equals your marginal cost. And I look at you and I say, well, now how can I maximize my profit if my revenues equals my costs? So how would you prove to me that profits are maximized where MR equals MC?
Well,
No. Huh? How would you prove this to me? Well, now, when we're looking at the proof, aware of why profits are maximized where M equals MC, where do we begin? The one unit. We always begin at the beginning. And where is the beginning? The first unit. So, let's say we own a manufacturing firm and we want to know how many units to produce to maximize our profit. So using marginal analysis, we start with the first unit. So now the question becomes, should we or should we not produce the first unit? And what's the answer?
If revenue exceeds cost?
Yes, on that first unit, right? If on this first unit, we're going to bring in more money than what this first unit costs us to produce, then we're going to make money if we produce the first unit, correct? So let's say that's true. Let's say, okay, my revenue on this unit is greater than what this unit cost me to produce, so I'm going to produce this first unit. Okay, now what do I do? Go to the next unit. See, that's why this is called marginal analysis. We're only looking at one unit at a time. The first, the second, the third, the fourth, each unit at a time. So we go to the second unit, and we ask the same question. Should we or should we not produce the second unit? And what's the answer? If our revenue on that unit exceeds what that one unit cost us to produce, then we'll produce the second unit. So then what do? Go to the third unit. And we ask the same question. Should we produce a third unit, and what's the answer? Same answer, right? In other words, as long as MR is greater than MC, what are we going to do?
Produce more.
Produce. Yeah, exactly, right. We're going to produce that last unit. MR greater than MC, we produce it. MR greater than MC on the next unit, we produce it. MR is greater than MC in the third unit, we produce it. MR is greater than MC, MR is greater than MC, MR is greater than MC, MR is greater than MC. And we keep on producing as long as MR is greater than MC. Now, what's the case of, let's say for the first unit, MR is greater than MC by $1,000, and on the 25th unit, MR is greater than MC by 10 cents. Yeah, because we want, it's irrelevant how much we're making. The only question is, are we making money or are we not? If it's $1,000 or 10 cents, it's irrelevant. So as long as MR is greater than MC, whether that be a lot more or just a little more, we're going to produce that last unit. Yeah.
So if the last unit's not greater, if the revenue is not greater,
is that the maximum? Well, I'm going to get there. Yeah, you're just one step ahead of me. Now, catch hold of this. First unit, MR greater than MC. Second unit, MR greater than MC. Third unit, MR greater than MC. 10th unit, MR is greater than MC. 20th unit, MR is greater than MC. On the 21st unit, now let's say that for the first 20 units, we've made $1,000. MR, you know, our revenues are greater than our costs, and totally we've made $1,000. All right, on the 21st unit, MR equal MC. If we produce the 25th unit, how much money will we make overall?
$1,000.
If we don't produce the 25th unit, you know, that unit where MR equals MC, what would our total revenue be, our total profits be?
$1,000.
So, see, really, it makes no difference, right? Because if MR equals MC, that means the revenue we received in that last unit equals what that last unit cost us to produce, and therefore, we're not making any money, but then we're not losing any money. Now, if we go one unit, let's say the 26th unit, and now MR is less than MC, let's say MR is less than MC by $1. Now, if we produce a 26th unit, will we still make a profit?
No. Yes.
Yes. Right? We'll still make a profit. But will we maximize our profit if we produce a 26th unit? No. Why? Because we have lost money on the last unit. See? So even though we may have still made a profit overall, we're not maximizing our profit if we produce that 26th unit. So what we say in this economics here, this micro, is we say that profits are maximized where MR equals MC. Or the last unit where MR is greater than MC, since it doesn't make any difference in terms of dollars and cents. Now, why do we always talk about MR equals MC? Well, because it looks good on a graph. If we look at a graph and we've got a marginal revenue curve and we've got a marginal cost curve and they're going to intersect at some point, then we know, okay, this is where we're going to produce to maximize your profit or minimize your losses. Because, you see, it's quite simple. Now, if we're given information on a table and not a graph, it's possible, since a table is more detailed than a graph, it's possible that MR will never equal MC. I mean, in reality, it would be highly unusual for MR to equal MC at a whole unit of output. In reality, what will normally happen is that MR is greater than MC, MR is greater than MC, MR is greater than MC, and then all of a sudden at a certain unit, MR will be less than MC. But MR will never equal MC.
For the maximum is the last unit you've got profit.
Yeah. Yeah, your profits are always maximized at your profits are always maximized at the last unit where MR is greater than MC. Now, if MR happens to equal MC, then that's also a choice. But see, if we're looking at a graph, well, it's always where MR equals MC because a graph may not even give us numbers. See, that's the advantage of a graph over a table. The advantage of a graph over a table is that we can see the bigger picture. See, we can talk about these things with a graph and have no numbers at all, just the curves. But with a table, what's the advantage of a table over a graph? Well, the advantage of a table over a graph is that it's more detailed. Of course, the disadvantage is that it's not as easy to see the bigger picture with a table. See, the advantages and disadvantages. The advantage of a graph is we can see the bigger picture easily. The disadvantage is it's not as detailed. The advantage with a table is that it's more detailed, but the disadvantage is that we can't see the bigger picture quite as easily. So what I'm saying is that if we're looking at this information on a table, well, MR may never equal MC. But we look at the MC column and the MR column, and we know the profits are maximized at the last unit where MR is greater than MC. Now, if we're looking at it at a graph, then it's just where the MR and MC curves intersect. Anyway, you're going to get lots of practice with this. But here is the information on a table. Well, you can't see that, can you? How's that? Here's the information on a table. Now, I've warned you before that a lot of what you're going to be expected to do is read a table and answer a multitude of questions. Or it may be a graph. On the test on this information, there's going to be lots of graphs and lots of tables. So the test will give you a table and say, okay, based on this information, and then it may have five or six questions. So you've got lots of practice with this. That's one of the advantages here is you've got lots of practice. And here you notice that on the first column we got Q, stands for quantity. And in the second column, we get marginal revenue. Now, why is marginal revenue always the same number? In this case, it's 5. How come marginal revenue is always 5, regardless of the number of units? How come marginal revenue is always 5?
The last unit?
But why is it always 5? Because what's one of the characteristics of a perfect competitive market? One of the characteristics is that we can sell everything we bring to market at the market price.
Which is 5.
In this case, it's 5.
Yeah.
So we're saying that if we sell one unit, how much are we adding to our total revenue? $5. If we sell a second unit, how much are we adding to our total revenue? $5. If we sell a third unit, how much are we adding to our see what I mean?
Yeah.
So marginal revenue is always 5 because 5 is the market price in this case. All right, third column is total revenue. Now, total revenue is price times quantity, right? Total revenue is how many units do we sell? In this case, our price is what?
$5.
How many units do we, are we selling here? 10. What's 10 times 5? 50 total revenue. See, total revenue is, okay, how many units are we selling and how much we get for each unit? All right, the fourth column is TC, which stands for total cost. And here, this total cost is just given information. You know, you can't get total cost except if it's just given information. So we have a total cost figures here. But we can calculate marginal cost. Now, how do we get $2.75 as the marginal cost for the... for the 10th unit? Well, that may be a little unfair. Let me ask you this instead. How did we get $3.25 as the marginal cost for the 11th unit? No, you're looking at the wrong one.
Total cost?
Yeah, what about total cost?
It's more than what it was. It's more than the last unit.
But how much more?
$3.25.
So that's how we get $3.25. That's the answer.
Okay. Well,
the reason why my first question was an unfair one, you know, I just happened to pick 10, but see, we don't know the figures for 9 units. So that's why 10 was a poor choice. So that's why I went down to 11. See, at marginal cost was $2.25 at 11 units because at 10 units, our total cost was $40, right? At the 11th unit, our total cost is $43.25, right? So how much do we add to our total cost by going from 10 units to 11 units? $3.25. Yeah, the difference is if you're looking at marginal cost, it's always a difference between the total cost of this number of units and the total cost of the previous number of units. Now, if we're looking at marginal revenue, then it would be your total revenue from this number of units compared to your total revenue of the previous units, right? See, it's how much we add to total revenue by one more unit, or with cost to a marginal cost, how much we add to our total cost from the last unit. So if we know our totals from the previous unit and our totals to the present unit, the difference is the margin. So you always got to keep in mind that margin always means a change. A change. You know, there is no such thing as a margin unless a change takes place. Well, what change are we talking about? Well, either the change in total revenue or the change in total cost, which would be either marginal revenue or marginal cost. All right, in the... And the next column, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 column here on slide 14, we have ATC, which stands for average total cost. Now, what is the definition of average cost. Now, sometimes we just say average cost. Sometimes we say average total cost. Sometimes this will be AC. Sometimes it'll be ATC. It just depends on the author. But at any rate, what is the definition of average cost? What is an average?
You have to add some things and divide by the total number.
Yeah. Well, we take our total, and divide by number of units. Right? An average is always your total divided by number of units. In this here, we look at column 4. We got our total cost at 10 units is 40, and our total cost is at 10 units is 40. And it's 10 units, so what's 40 divided by 10?
4.
And that's how we get 4 in our average total cost column. Now, the last column is profit. Now, what is profit? But what is that here according to these numbers?
10.
But how do we know it's 10? Profit. Minus.
Minus 10.
Yeah, I mean, profit is total revenue minus total cost. Right? Profit is, okay, how much money do we bring in? How much money do we have to pay out? If we bring in more than we had to pay out, then that's profit. So, profit is total revenue minus total cost. Well, the third column gives us total revenue, and the fourth column gives us total cost, so we simply subtract total cost from total revenue, and that's how we get the last column, which is profit. Okay, so anyway, you're given all these numbers here in this graph, and then you're asked the question, okay, how many units are we going to produce to maximize our profit? Now, in this case, I've given you the answer. The answer here is how many units? 12, right? But how do we know it's 12? But how do we know that? How do we know by looking at these numbers that our profits are maximized at 12 units? Because how do we calculate maximizing profits? Where are our profits maximized? Or if MR never equals MC, they're maximized where at the last unit where
MR exceeds MC.
Exactly, where MR exceeds MC. So let's look at this. Here we've on the second column we got marginal revenue. On the fifth column we've got marginal cost, and we say, okay, let's see, at quantity 10, marginal revenue is 5, marginal cost is $2.75. Should we produce the 10th unit?
Yes.
Because we're making money on the 10th unit. All right, on the 11th unit, marginal revenue is 5, marginal cost is $3.25. Should we produce the 11th unit?
Yes.
Why? Because we're making money in the 11th unit. Okay, at 12 units, marginal revenue is 5 and marginal cost is $4.75. Should we produce the 12th unit?
Yes,
because we're making money on the 12th unit. Okay, in the 13th unit, marginal revenue is 5 and marginal cost is $6.50. Oh, now, if we produce the 13th unit, what's happening? Now, we're still making a profit of $10.50. We're not, what's that word? We're not, that's the word. The word is maximizing. We're not maximizing our profit if we produce the 13th unit. Why? Because we lost money on the 13th unit. Now, can I say that if we produce 13 units that we've lost money? Well, no, we still made $10.50 profit. So we haven't lost money, but we have lost money on the last unit, and therefore we have not maximized our profit if we produce the 13th unit. So how many units do I produce to maximize my profit? 12. See, notice here that MR did not equal MC anywhere. So we had to revert back to the, well, it's the last unit where MR is greater than MC.
Or the quantity for 13. Is there any way that you move that box real quick and be on like...
The what now? I'm sorry. No, I can't do that. I don't know what, why that's... No. But you can refer to it on the PowerPoint slides. You know, it would be a good idea, by the way, to print out these PowerPoint slides and then bring them into class and, you know, take notes on them. I don't encourage you to print the slides for study purposes per se, because for one thing, they're very brief and they're too sketchy for you to really get much out of them by themselves. And another thing is that you don't want to, you know, slip into using your memory. But these slides are handy, you know, to bring into class and take notes on. Okay, why does MR equal P in perfect competition? Why does marginal revenue always equal price in perfect competition?
Market price?
Yeah, exactly. Because the market sets the price, and if the market sets the price and we're selling everything at the same price, correct? See, right? See, in other type markets, if we want to sell more, what do we got to do?
You want to sell more?
Yeah. In other type markets, if you want to sell more, we would
lower
our price. But is that true in perfect competition?
No.
Because in perfect competition, yeah, we got a set price, and at that set price that's set by the market, we can sell everything we bring to market, no matter how many units we bring, see? So in perfect competition, marginal revenue, you see, always equals price. See, because no matter how many units are brought to market, the firm can sell all of them at the market price. So marginal revenue equals price in a perfectly competitive market. Is that true for other markets?
No.
Well, we'll see when we get there. Okay. But right now, let's concentrate on perfect competition.
Well,
this is concentrate on perfect competition now, because in the next chapter, we'll talk about monopoly. Okay, what is average revenue? Total revenue divided by output, right? Is average revenue? And why does average revenue equal price? Because each unit is sold for the same price at one point in time, right? I mean, if we're selling all our units for the same price, then every time we take our total revenue divided by quantity, what are we always going to get back to? The price. And the price is always the same. So average revenue equals price. All right, now here we've got a basic graph where we put everything that we've learned together and we start looking at it to make decisions. Now, what decisions do we want to make? We want to make decisions of what price we're going to charge and what quantity we're going to produce to maximize our profit, or at least minimize our losses. Now, see, why would a firm produce while making a loss?
Why would they produce while making a loss?
Mm-hmm. Why would a firm continue to produce while making a loss?
Because you're only losing on that last unit?
No, if you're making a loss overall. Why would a firm continue to produce if the firm is making a loss?
Are they looking long then?
Well, it's got something to do with...
Would they be trying to stop?
It's got something to do with the short run and the long run. No, it's got something to do with the short run and the long run.
maybe they might have changed capacity.
Well, what time frame are we talking about?
Longer.
Now, what do we always assume?
Everything's constant.
Well, we assume.
We're talking about the short run.
Yeah, we're talking about the short run. Now, the difference between short run and long run is
capacity.
Therefore, in the short run, we have what? We have fixed costs. Now, if our losses are less than our fixed costs, should we stay open or close down?
Close down.
No. If our losses are less than our fixed costs, stay open. Because even though we're making a loss, if we close down, our fixed costs would be greater than our loss. Now, we have fixed costs because, well, we're talking about the short run here. See, now, see, if we're talking about the long run, would this be true? Well, no, in the long run, we don't have any fixed costs. In the long run, all our costs are variable. But in the short run, we've got certain fixed costs. So in the short run time frame, we may continue to operate even though we're making a loss because our losses may be less than our fixed costs. You know, this is true with big industries like steel or railroads. You know, we've got certain businesses here that are so large that they have definite fixed costs. So a business like that may continue to operate for a year, you know, several years, while still making a loss. Well, why would they do that? Because their fixed costs are greater than their losses. Now, if you make a loss, you make a loss, you make a loss, I mean, eventually, what might you do? And what might you do as a result? But if you close down, what's happened to our time frame? We've gone from the short run to the long run, you see. So, see, we're talking about a different situation here, a different time frame. But in the short run, see, we'll continue to operate if our losses are less than our fixed costs. Okay, so here we have this graph with the different curves on it. So let's make sure we understand this. First of all, we've got a horizontal line at $5. Exactly. That was my answer to my next question, because $5 is the market price. And notice here that we have a little d. Not a capital D, but a little d. Because one firm, exactly. Because this is our single firm's demand curve, right? Our single firm's demand curve is a horizontal line at the market price. All right, now this $5 also equals margin revenue. Now, how come that is? Because every time we sell one more unit, what are we doing?
Maximizing profit?
No. We're talking about margin revenue and $5. Every time we sell another unit, what are we doing? We're adding $5 to our total revenue. And therefore, margin revenue equals price. In this case, $5. All right, now the next one is average revenue. Now, what is average revenue? Well, average revenue is total revenue divided by quantity. Now, why is average revenue always $5? Because no matter how many units we sell, if we take our total revenue and divide it by quantity, what are we always going to get back to?
The market price.
Yeah, the market price, which is $5. So what we've got here is that on this horizontal line, we've got four things that are equal. It's the market price, firm short-run demand curve, margin revenue curve, and average revenue curve.
What was the second one?
Small d. See, $5. Yeah, just follow it. $5, small d, MR, AR. All right. Here we have an average total cost curve. and its average total cost curve is U-shaped. Now, why is that? I mean, why is it that starting from zero, as we produce more units, our cost in the average goes down, but beyond a certain point, as we increase units, our average costs go up? Now, why is that?
It's resources.
No. Because of the law of diminishing returns. Okay, our average total cost curve is U-shaped because of the law of diminishing returns. And our marginal cost curve is U-shaped because why? Because of the law of diminishing returns. All right. How many units are we going to produce to maximize our profit?
12.
And how do we know it's 12? Come on now. Where?
Maximize your profit at that last unit, which is 12.
No. Where are profits always maximized?
Where marginal revenue equals marginal cost.
Exactly. So where's your marginal revenue curve? At $5. Right? Marginal revenue is always $5. And where's our marginal cost curve? Well, that's that U-shaped, at the red curve, right? We're in slide 18 here. And so where do the two curves intersect? At 12 units. So our profits are maximized if we produce 12 units. Why? Because that's where MR equals MC. Now, what is our average profit?
$4?
No.
No.
Now, what is average revenue? Now, here is a little trick. Here's a little trick. You always want to compare like units. Average with average, totals with totals. Now, profit is what? Total revenue minus total cost. What's average profit? Average revenue minus average cost, correct?
Right.
All right, now look at this graph. What is average revenue?
$5.
$5. What is average cost?
$4. So a dollar.
Exactly. See, our average profit is a dollar. Now here's you know, we've got some people that left, but I mean, left at a bad time. Here's a trick. I'm going to ask you a question. Now, the question's always the same. The question is going to be, how many units am I going to produce to maximize my profit? Now, that's always the question, and what's always the answer?
If total revenue...
No. Well, come on now.
How many units?
Where are your profits maximized?
At the last unit.
Come on. How many units are you going to produce to maximize profit? You're going to produce where? Marginal revenue equals marginal cost. Correct?
Right.
That's always the case. See, this is quite simple because the questions and answers never change. First question, how many units are you going to produce to maximize profit? What's the answer? Where MR equals MC.
Right.
Right? Same question, same answer. Mm-hmm. All right, now, once you find where MR equals MC, and this is the point I was getting to, you draw a vertical line all the way up and all the way down. See, MR equals MC. You got an MR curve and an MC curve, correct? And they intersect someplace. In this case, it's 12 units. Now, once we find 12 units, we draw a vertical line up and down, and the answers So all the other questions will fall on that vertical line. Okay, so the reason why this is important is that you don't have to look at the whole graph. Because if you look at the whole graph, it could become complicated. All you got to do is look at that vertical line. All right? Now, the difference, therefore, between E and A is average profit. And since we produce 12 units, our total profit is 12 times 1, or $12. Anyway, we're going to get, I'm going to give you lots of practice with this, and so this really ends the this lecture, certainly not the chapter, but we'll leave off here in slide 18, so I'll see you a week from today, right?
Yep.
And we'll continue this next Monday.